very happy to welcome you. Hunter Beaumont is a clinical psychologist and one of the founders of the Epistemical Systemic Association and also the director of the workshop for family reconciliation. You are representing a general psychotherapy approach. Now, people are talking a lot about guilt bonds in the media, but it's mostly with an economic focus. However, it's an emotional subject, which is why we are very much looking forward to listening to you, because you will talk about the individual experience of guilt, and you will show the connection between debt, guilt, and bonds. Hunter Beaumont, over to you.
Es ist für mich eine große Ehre, hier in diesem Haus eingeladen.
It's a great honor for me to be invited here to the House of World Cultures. And I'm particularly honored to talk about psychology in this context. This is a courageous approach, I'd say, but concepts like bond can be understood in very different terms, i.e. in the economic context. It's very different from the psychological context. Bonds have a different meaning. Now, whether the difference is a purely semantic one or whether there is an impact that goes beyond remains to be seen. I hope I'll be able to convince those of you who have not been convinced of it yet that the psychological dimension might also be important with respect to the political and economic situation. Now, seen from the psychological perspective, a bond, is a strong emotional connection between two human beings or an individual and a group. Now, these bonds are not controlled by the parts of your brain that control rational action. They rather underlie a limbic control, which means that only to a certain extent you can influence the emotion involved and solve the problem. However, the emotional intensity of a bond can be a major one, and it can truly turn relations upside down, meaning that an individual takes care of somebody else or another's survival, often at the expense of his or her own life. Now, this is the true emotional power of the process. Now, bonds, that's about a very early stage of human or animal evolution, of evolution as such. This is about membranes and exchanges and the capability of acting in a crowd. Now, bonds, like all emotions, make us vulnerable because we may experience and feel pain, but also euphoria, enthusiasm, and joy. Now, you know the concept of bonding or attachment in psychotherapy, and I've just mentioned bonding as an emotion. And you know that Darwin was very interested in the importance of emotion, and he said that emotion is vital for life and for the survival, because emotion enshrines or implies motivations. Now, Konrad Lorenz was the next to get involved in this subject matter. You all know the pictures of Konrad Lorenz and the little ducks or geese surrounding him. John Bowlby, an English psychiatrist, focused on the attachment or bonding between mothers and children, based on Konrad Lorenz's theories, and Mrs. Ainsburg and Mary Main, two of his students, focused on the statistical implication of bonding between parents and children. The two found in their surveys and protocols that the early experience of parents and children have a major impact on the future capability of bonding of children. And if children can talk to their parents even before they are born, the two scholars talk to parents before their children were born, and with a probability of 80%, they were right to anticipate the later bonding structure between parents and children. Now, there is a lot of literature about prenatal and postnatal bonding and bonding between children and parents as a whole. Now, in the last 10 years, emotions have been in the focus of research, which is also due to the progress that has been made in the field of brain research. You all know that brain scans can be done, and you can now examine living human beings and you can assess their brain functionalities in real time. Now, in addition to the bonding relationship between children and parents, their mothers in particular, there are also bondings between different groups or species, between men and children. And if you ever walk through a park in Berlin, you can also observe the bonding between dogs and human beings. Now, this is a picture I have taken from a daily newspaper in San Francisco. It's about a whale caught in a net, and the whale was about to drown. So a fisher saw the whale struggling, and he called an animal protection association, and a number of people came and took care of the whale for many hours, and they cut the net off him. And whilst they were working, the whale was unmoved, so to speak, and one of the men who tried to save the humpback whale caught in the net said it was so impressive to look the whale into the eye. And after the animal was saved, was rescued, he looked at each and every of his saviors as if in gratitude. Now, the picture, and I took it with my iPhone from the newspaper, shows bonding. Bonding that involves animals. I will show you five more pictures to illustrate different types of bonding. Now, I would like to invite you to consider the emotional impact of the images. I would like to show you the pictures now.
Von diesen Bildern wird, glaube ich, deutlich.
I think these pictures clearly show that none of the persons involved sat down and asked himself or herself whether he or she should embark on a bonding process with the beings involved. So this is not an ego-controlled decision in spite of the fact that you can avoid it by use of your ego. No one had to tell the father you see on the picture what he should feel with respect to his child. Now, he was an Iraq war veteran, and he came back from the war and he saw his baby for the first time. I mean, I don't think that this is an authentic photograph. I guess this has been produced in a studio, but still it gives you an idea of what he feels, and it also shows you why he thinks that his job as a soldier makes sense. Now, if a soldier is to serve his child, if he goes to war in order to protect his child or serve his child, his job makes sense. And this is the emotional impact that is involved here. Now, what have we learned in sciences about bonding? We know, as I said, that bonding has come up as a phenomenon in the evolution at a very early stage. Lizards, for example, do not really bond, and 90% of the babies of crocodiles are usually eaten by other crocodiles. But then birds. With the birds, the relationship changed, and parents started to take care of their children, and bees and ants also take care of their children, but we won't consider bees or ants today. And then with mammals, a new way of dealing with one's descendants started. That is to say, the descendants of mammals are born in a much less mature condition than reptiles. I mean, a lizard just born can do what an adult lizard can do, apart from sex. For mammals, it's different. Mammals can't do this, and mammals include human beings as well. Now, the interesting bit is that the baby once had to be able to show his or her parents where he or she was. Now, this is the cry of separation which many mammals can do. So they shout, they cry for their parents. If an alligator could do this, and if other alligators would hear it, it would be eaten. Now, here am I, that's what the child cries, and parents recognize their children, and they can hardly resist. They have to approach their child, or they have to do something at least. And if they don't want to do anything at all, they get excited. But there is another impact we have to see here, which is very important for our political and ethical work, because human beings are characterized by the fact that the older areas of the brain are more mature than the left cortex at birth. In other words, there is a lot of, parents have a lot of time to determine, to shape the development, the evolution of their children. Now, in the more recent brain research, two concepts have been coined. I guess you know them. One is neuroplasticity, and the other is the epigenetics. Now, both are extremely important in the context we are considering here. Epigenetics draws our attention to the fact that it does not only matter what genes we have, but whether these genes are being activated or switched on, and when and to what extent, and whether the genes are being switched on or off depends on the experience you make in life or in the world. And the same goes for neuroplasticity. A newborn baby is being born with a number of synapses, more than it will have at a later stage in life. So the synapses which are not being used get lost and new ones are being produced. Bruce Perry, an expert for child trauma in the United States, said that in the 8 months of a person's life, a peak is reached, and you have 1 square centimeter in your brain in which per hour 80,000 new synapses are being produced. That's quite a lot. Which means, however, that the way we are, what we think, how we think, what genetic potential is being activated or deactivated, and how our brain works depends, to a certain extent at least, on the very first relationship we have in life. Culture is then the context in which evolution selects, meaning we indirectly control our own evolution or development by offering a context in which a certain choice is made, a certain selection takes place, which means that the political perspective is extremely important also in the psychological context. Also, the question of belief, of faith, of interest, of your will to research, your interest in research, your capacity of looking at different perspectives simultaneously. Now, these are skills you have to learn and to train. May I also present you a number of results from brain research, because they are important. Brain research is extremely complex, and please bear with me, I will simplify a lot. It is, however, important to remember Paul MacLean, who developed a model of the brain in the 1960s, and he wanted to teach us that in the evolution, the brain produced overlays, i.e., old structures remained, existed furthermore, and new structures were added. Now, the first one was the reptile brain, which controls our heartbeat and our wish to eat. I mean, that's what we have, but that's what reptiles have too. So that was the reptile brain. And then there was the limbic structure of the brain. That's what we share with the mammals, i.e. the capacity of bonding and the capacity of establishing personal relationships and the capacity of emotion. And then at the very end, the cortex began to exist. And it's interesting that to note that in children, the left hemisphere has different capacities from the right one. And experts say that only 40% of your brain are conscious. That's the optimistic opinion, however, because it's much more probable that much less is conscious activity of our brain. So bonding is part of the limbic part of our brain. The limbic brain, as in dogs, does not know any language, which is the neurophysiological reason why it is so difficult to adequately talk about certain emotions. There was a great poet. Can say what he means, what he feels, but he needs metaphors. He needs images to really convey his message and make people understand what he feels. Now, if we consider bonding and emotional capacity of the limbic brain, and here you realize that this is not about a conscious decision of the ego, and this is not something which is immediately subject to one's will. I mean, remember the young lady you saw on the picture standing at the grave of her fiancé. That's an interesting story, by the way. They were students. They studied at the same university in America. And he wanted to study medicine, and he had to take loans. And the only possibility he saw to get the money he needed in order to study medicine was to join the army for 4 years so that his studies would be paid. So they decided to postpone the marriage. But then he died in Iraq. Now, if you try to feel the grief, what she feels when she lies there on the ground, on the grave, you realize that this is about lost hope and lost possibilities. And you see, that's not her decision. She did not decide to feel in such an intensive way. It just happened. Obviously, her limbic brain wanted her to feel the pain. And if you agree to extend the concept so that you include the limbic brain, the question of the free will becomes a completely different one, and the context changes too. The language of bonding in tradition was usually one using the vocabulary of love, guilt, duty, honor, i.e. concepts which try to understand the very meaning of the human capability of bonding with others in a genuine way. So let me repeat. Bonding is nothing reasonable or rational, never. Bonding of bonds can also be dangerous Because if you are really bound to someone and something happens to the person, it has an immediate impact for me and on me. And you know that parents want to die before their children if they know that their children are doing well. So this is the transformation of evolutionary structures we are dealing with here. And let me also repeat, the emotional dimension is the heart of life. This is where a lot of what we appreciate happens, the joy and pleasure in discovery, research, intimacy, suffering, loneliness, depression. If things don't happen the way we want them to be.
Ich versuche jetzt eine Brücke zu bauen.
I will now try and bridge the gap, so as to close the gap and to the context of the conference. I'm not an economic expert, though. If you take a look at my investments, you know that I'm not a dab hand at spending and dealing with money. Well, I'm going to shed light on the context and will also be available for questions. It seems to be the case to me that religion, culture, political cultures have tried to generate the limbic activation, but then couple this to proposals for solutions which are not helpful to the person concerned. I'm thinking about an example. Michael Moore, the filmmaker, I suppose you know him. Michael Moore has made films about the economic situation, the healthcare system in the United States of America. And he holds the view that the American policy systematically tries to generate fear and anxiety. This is a limbic threat. And then they offer political solutions which do not really provide a service. They are wrong, as it were. But they, the media, do have this capacity of offering something to certain limbic structure, of offering solutions that then are being coupled together. There are neurophysiological explanations to this. They explain how this works. And this limbic motivation then does not act at the benefit of life, but at the benefit of political ideas. I can remember commercials in the US. A young woman is shown, for example, she's lonely, she does not find a partner at a party. And the offer, the proposal, the solution was to change the toothpaste. If it is correct, all right, that culture really has a design effect on the neurosynaptic functioning of the brain. And if the limbic potential and power is being changed and coupled at the service of what is wrong, well, then we can link this to the term of bond in the economic context. Because behind these bonds, you very often have changes of wishes and, secondly, promises that cannot be kept. I spoke to old people in a Bavarian village, and these people told me that when they were young and they wanted to open a shop, you started bargaining. If you wanted to make a business, say, and then you shook hands and there was a moment in time you were looking into the other's eyes and you could rely on this business. This kind of contract was legally binding to them. And in this village, everybody made sure that the agreement that was made was positive to the two parties, because in a small village, if there's an economic agreement which is positive for the one person and negative to the other person, this would disrupt the village's structure. That means this shaking of hands has a limbic authenticity, to put it in today's terminology. It has meant something, and it was legally binding. You go to a bank, say you want to have a loan or a mortgage for a house, and you start negotiating with a person you do not know. You do not know if the advice you get is really good, or if it is just provided so that the banker will get a commission. You don't know if you can rely on the person. You then sign an agreement, and very often this signature does not have the emotional effect of the fact of shaking hands. This is a different kind of contract. We then learned in this society how to survive. We need to protect the limbic dimension against abuse. And this is one reason, I believe, because so many people are careful, they are afraid of emotions. And this is something that you realize. You feel that emotions can have a very negative impact without appropriate training and understanding. These emotions might be abused. Now I would like to talk about guilt. You can understand and see guilt as an emotion that is being caused if a bond is infringed, if a bond is not accepted. In my clinical work, it has been very helpful to differentiate between guilt and the feeling of feeling guilty. Guilt forces you to act. A guilty conscience, though, does not. For many years, you can ponder about a guilty conscience forcefully without doing anything about it. If you take a look at these pictures, you see that there is the picture of the soldier holding the child and the other soldiers around him. This is an important picture. But it is important to see what is to the fore that grasps your attention. And it's a soldier, is a bit older already. And you can see him holding a child. And it is very likely, you can assume by looking at the picture, that he has just injured or killed the child. It is not sure, but this is something that you can read between the lines. And he sees the child. It might be dead. We don't know if the child is just wounded or dead. But the child triggered a limbic structure in the soldier. And he was sitting there. He had no choice. He simply had to hug and embrace the child. So you can feel this power of this instinct. You might call them instincts as well. Interestingly enough, though, if you take a look at the picture, you also see the other soldiers. They are in the background and they look away. This is quite interesting as well. You need to ask, what makes this possible? that you are able to look away from such a child. If you've spoken to veterans, you know that they were under emotional pressure, that they felt the pressure of the social system, that they were anxious, afraid, that they could not afford to feel something like this, that something that the one soldier afforded to feel. It is better for their health not to feel that much, because if they felt this feeling, they would be forced to act. And to act in these military contexts, according to your conscience, means that you will bear very serious negative consequences. So we all learned to not to take into account this. We've trained this. Everybody of us can walk around in the streets of Berlin and simply ignore certain situations and people. It is necessary to do that. The question, though, is, what is the balance that is appropriate for a healthy state of the society as a whole? You know, in the US, we've just had the general elections or the presidential elections. Maybe this term is a little bit exaggerated for what happened, but, well, at least. And if you listen to the polemics on both sides, then you realize, on both sides, I would like to stress, you feel that there's a systematic shift of the description of the situation. And this systematic change triggers certain emotional reactions. I'm rather a left-winger. This is why I listen to the arguments of the right-wingers of the Tea Party or of the people coming from the hinterland when they talk about President Obama. I feel the hatred, the fear, the anxiety and their energy when talking about him. And this energy is not rational. It is not reasonable either. But it is systematically controlled by political argumentation. This is an abuse of the limbic capacities. I'm a little bit shy of saying this in this context, but let me use my vocabulary. I use the term soul so as to give a name to this emotional level. It's not a metaphysical or theological term. It is a term which helps you to give a name to the emotional capacities we have. Now, if we differentiate between guilt and guilty conscience, we realize that guilt forces you to act and guilty conscience forces you to ponder things. And if you want to avoid the consequences of your actions, it is appropriate to change guilt to make sure that it will become a guilty conscience. Guilt is something that you can solve relatively easily if you are willing to act. It is also interesting in my everyday practical work to see this. Guilt was less important than shame for my generation. Shame is also a limbic structure. Shame feels completely different compared to guilt. Because if you feel guilty, then you have a guilt for what you've done. I feel guilty that, or because I did that, this and that, or because I didn't do certain things. But in the experience of feeling ashamed, then you feel wrong yourself. And you say to yourself, I'm not acceptable, there's something wrong about me. And I can't readjust this. An attack of shame can happen relatively easily in your everyday life. Maybe you feel it by being speechless, or you want the ground to swallow you up because you feel that shame. Maybe there's you feel it in your brain, you're paralyzed in your brain. But this is also a limbic reaction. There's a moral psychologist, Jonathan Haidt. He did interesting research. Transcultural and transsocial layers is what he took into account. He did a major academic study in Philadelphia. Two groups of the upper class and lower class, 1,400 participants were involved. And once he went to a small village in Brazil to carry out this study. And here again, he asked people of the upper class and the lower class as well. And he realized that there are more discrepancies between the upper class and the lower class of the one and the same place compared to the differences between the upper class and the upper class and the lower class and the lower class in the two places. What does that mean? This is what he calls the foundation of our moral feelings. This seems to be universal, but the cultural characterization of content is very different. And he tried to describe the foundations of moral feeling irrespective of the content. He also carried out studies in the US and compared this to India. And there's another cultural, religious context in India, of course. Some things were completely different compared to the US. Sometimes this was a contradiction even, but the basic idea about if something is good or bad or fair or unfair was the same. From a psychological perspective, if you talk about guilt, then this is an aspect which is important. But I haven't heard economists speak about it. Some people have accepted debt so as to survive. In the US, people have made debts so as to create something that is just an appearance. They wanted to pretend that they had a different economic stability to the one they actually had. They had been convinced by others that they needed something that they actually do not need, something that is bigger, for instance, or better. And again, from a psychological perspective, this shows there is a lack of capacity to verify what exactly you need. And a limbic feeling of scarcity is caused in the cortex. You feel, I need to buy another toothpaste, a bigger computer, a bigger car, or a bigger house. And if you act according to this interpretation, well, this is no longer a dissonance with yourself. And the capacity to verify things is the integration of the intellect and the emotion of the cortex and the limbic system. And this is something that needs to be learned and trained. It is mainly up to education and family cultures. And one last point. These bonds are mostly found outside the area of language. And this is why we do not always know with what and how we are bonded to others. The work that we do in psychology show that there are amazing impacts and effects going beyond the generations. And this offers us a possibility of simulating a bonding system, which is relatively simple, very prone to problems with a noise and signal. And yet, in spite of it, it is sufficient for us to provide information about the unsolved bonds that still act. I would like to give you one example. A German psychology student came to see me and had certain symptoms. He could not sleep. And he couldn't study. He was not very effective during his studies. He had horrible nightmares about fire and other things. And about things flying around in his nightmare. But it was not possible to find a reason for this in his everyday life. He was rather very well adapted. And when he started to get interested in his family history, it was found that his grandfather had an important political position in the city of Dachau. And when his grandfather died, whilst the student was still in the therapy, the student got the task to look through his grandfather's papers, and he found a card of the concentration camp in Dachau, and the grandfather wrote Lügen on it, Lügen meaning lies, in bold letters. And this is something that the son and the student did not know consciously, but it still had an effect on him. To me, as an American, I don't have a common history together with black people or Indians, but still, if I see a black person or an American Indian, if I meet them somewhere in the street, this has an effect of guilt, of an intertwined bond, which is something that did not happen in my generation, but it nevertheless has an impact on me. I'll leave this open without discussing this further. I've got one last provocation. I saw a nice TED talk the other day, forgot who offered this. And the topic of the TED talk was the Arab term jihad. And it was said that the term of jihad is being abused, and it is kind of non-defined so that it does not have a good effect. And he says that the original meaning of the term indicates an inner spiritual process, which we can call verification. What are the values according to which I want to lead my life? Is what I'm doing acceptable if I also take into consideration the values I've got? And what do I need to do in my everyday life so that my everyday actions go hand in hand with my values? And where can I find what is important? So if jihad is a word which denominates this verification process, well, then I think we need not to be afraid of this term. And I would like to invite you all to find this process in your own way. Thank you.